First thing I wanted to do was to go over the answers from quiz three. So the first question asks you to define the terms oxidation reduction and then state common example of an oxidizing agent or a reducing agent. So the text did give a couple of different definitions for what an oxidation or reduction reaction is. The best definition is that oxidation is loss of electrons and reduction is a gain of electrons. Now, frequently, when something gains an oxygen, that also means it's effectively losing an electron. And similarly, when something gains a hydrogen, that's often related to it gaining electrons. But not all oxidation or reduction reactions involve oxygen or hydrogen. So it's better to focus on the oxidation states, which means it's better to focus on the fact that things either gain or lose electrons. So best definition is oxidation is loss of electrons, reduction is gain of electrons. As far as oxidizing agents, so there's a difference between chloride, which is Cl minus, and then chlorine, which is Cl2, the way that chlorine normally appears in its elemental form. So Cl minus is a form of chlorine that's already gained electrons. So the reason that chlorine, fluorine, those elements at the right-hand side of the periodic table like to be oxidizing agents is they're close to being in an octet format. But if they have a negative charge, they've already reached that octet format. So for an oxidizing agent, you need to list those elements in their elemental form, not in their ion form. Similarly, as far as reducing agents, common examples of reducing agents include things like lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, calcium, those things at the left-hand side of the periodic table. Similar case there, though. If you end up with the ions like sodium plus or calcium plus 2, those are ions that have formed because the elements have already lost their electrons. So for it to be a reducing agent, it needs to be the metal that's in its non-reacted form. So that was for question one. Question two is the one that, as a class, you all seem to have the most difficulty with. So let me write the equation out here. We had a reaction between nitric acid, HNO3, and sulfur dioxide, SO2. That forms sulfuric acid, H2SO4, and nitrogen dioxide, NO2. You're asked to come up with the oxidation state for each atom, and that's where you all seem to run into difficulty. So there were a handful of rules that we had learned for oxidation states. One of them is that hydrogen usually ends up a plus one oxidation state. And I did not give any trick questions. In other words, in these problems, it does turn out that each hydrogen has a plus one oxidation state. One of the other rules that you learned is that oxygen normally has a negative two oxidation state. The only exception to that I might have mentioned is if that oxygen is part of a peroxide. But that's a more advanced type of problem that I did not give. So in these examples, the oxygen had its regular negative two oxidation state. We did not have any monatomic ions except for hydrogen. And you might not have recognized it as being an ionic form. And so that rule you probably didn't end up using. So the other rule that we learned, though, is that the sum of all oxidation states has to add up to the overall charge of the substance. And so, for example, if we take apart nitric acid here, we had one hydrogen, we had one nitrogen, and we had three oxygens, and that all had to add up to zero because the overall charge on the compound ended up being zero. So if hydrogen has its normal oxidation state of plus one, And if oxygen has its normal oxidation state of -2, then we can substitute and solve. We're going to get 1 plus whatever the nitrogen is minus 6 is equal to 0. So the only way that could be true is if nitrogen ends up being equal to 5. So nitrogen in nitric acid has a plus 5 oxidation state. If we flip over to the other side here, you could use the same kind of logic to figure out that in the product, nitrogen now has a plus 4 oxidation state. Two oxygens, both of them -2. The only way you can balance that out to be neutral overall is if the nitrogen is plus 4. We can use similar kind of reasoning for the sulfur in both the product and reactants. So in the reactant, the sulfur is plus 4, just like nitrogen in the product is plus 4, because there's two oxygens that go along with it. And then if we look at sulfuric acid, I'll do the same kind of expansion there. We have two hydrogens, one sulfur, four oxygens that all add up to 0. So 2 times plus 1 plus the sulfur plus 4 times -2 equals 0. So we get 2 plus sulfur minus 8 equals 0, which means sulfur had to be a plus 6 oxidation state. So if you looked at the numbers that changed, nitrogen went from a plus 5 to a plus 4. Sulfur went from a plus 4 to a plus 6. So the nitrogen end up being reduced. So if HNO3 was reduced, that means it was the oxidizing agent. Or the oxidizer. Then if we look at the sulfur, sulfur was oxidized because it went from plus 4 to plus 6. And so that means that if SO2 was oxidized, so it was the reducing agent. Now, the thing that was oxidized isn't one of the products. The things that was reduced was not one of the products because that's what you end up with. So it has to be a reactant that ends up being oxidized or reduced. And it's also the reactants that were the oxidizing agents or reducing agents. So did anyone have any questions how I came up with any part of this answer, either the oxidation states or what the identities of the substances were? Okay, moving on to question 3. This was a question about electrochemical cell. So you were given a picture of a cell, and I'll replicate that picture here in the notes, where you had two different containers, one of which contained a solution of copper to nitrate, the other one that contained a solution of silver nitrate. In the copper nitrate solution, we had a copper electrode, and in the silver nitrate solution, we had a silver electrode. There was a wire that connected the two electrodes, and then it wasn't identified in the problem, but many of you figured out that the bottom part here was the salt bridge. So let me go ahead and write that in, that this is the salt bridge. So what you were asked to do is to identify what was the anode, what was the cathode, what was oxidized, or where was oxidation going on, and where was reduction going on. And the way to figure that out was based off a description of a reaction that was in the problem. So separate from the diagram itself, you had this description of copper metal being put into silver nitrate. And this happens to be the same example that I'd gone over in class. So it says, when copper metal is placed into silver nitrate, the copper metal disappears and is replaced by silver metal. And the solution turns blue because the copper has been turned into copper to nitrate. So what the problem is saying is that copper has gone from metal form to being an ion form, which means the copper is losing its electrons, which means copper metal is being oxidized. So that means that oxidation is going on in the left-hand side, the one that contains the copper electrode. Then if silver started out as silver nitrate and ends up as silver metal, that means that the silver gained electrons, and so that means reduction is going on in the right-hand side, the one that has the silver nitrate solution. So we have our two electrodes, the anode and cathode, and it's the anode that is the electrode where oxidation is occurring, and it's the cathode that is the electrode where reduction is occurring. And as far as which way electrons flow, that was one of the things you're asked to write down as well. So the electrons are coming off of copper, which is why the copper is forming ions, and then their electrons are therefore flowing over to the silver, where they're entering the solution to turn the silver nitrate into silver metal. Any questions on that cell? The next question was about salt bridges, which I accepted a wide variety of answers. You were asked to explain what the purpose of that salt bridge was. And I think the way that I described it in lecture is that it is something that contains a non-reactive material that is present to balance out charge. So some of you said that it balanced out the reaction, but I needed to have a little bit more specific answer than that, because I could say that, well, what is it? Whether it's a stoichiometrically balancing, whether it's in terms of number of atoms, and in this case, it's the charge that's being balanced. Because, for example, in the cell, if copper's being oxidized and that's all that's going on, then you're going to build up copper plus in solution. On the other side, if silver is being reduced, then you're going to be left over with just nitrate in the solution. And you can't have a solution that only has cations or only has anions. So the salt bridge in this case would allow anions to flow to the anode to match up with the copper ions that are being produced. And then there'd be some cations that would flow over the cathode to balance out with the nitrate that's left over. If you didn't have that, the cell would come to a halt because there wouldn't be a complete loop. So the movement of those ions is what allows the completion of the circuit, which is what allows the electrons to flow. Question five was asked you to define the term hydrocarbon. So hydrocarbon is a substance that contains only carbon and hydrogen. And then you were asked to explain the difference between saturated and unsaturated. So there the terminology mattered, because some of you said that saturated only has one bond, unsaturated has two or three bonds, which is not quite correct. Saturated means you have single bonds, which means you have single connections between atoms. But it doesn't mean you only have one bond, because the simplest hydrocarbon has four bonds in it. Methane has the formula CH4. So there is no hydrocarbon that only has one bond. So saturated means to have single bonds present. Although those of you who've been to lab this week know that the technical definition is a little bit more specific than that even. Has to do with the maximum number of hydrogens possible for a compound. Unsaturated, the way that we had talked about it in a lecture, means that we have double or triple bond present. So that's the difference between those two terms. Next question, you're asked to describe the relationship between isomers. So isomers are molecules with the same chemical formula but different structures. you're asked to draw any kind of pair of isomers, which there were two main types of isomers that many of you drew. Based off the terminology we reviewed in lab this week, some of you drew constitutional isomers, isomers that differ in the way that atoms are connected to each other. So some of you, for example, drew butane out as a line of four carbons versus drawing it in more of a triangular format. So that's one form of isomer. The other form of isomer that many of you drew were cis-trans isomers of double bond compounds, which would be forms of stereoisomers. For this problem on the quiz, you didn't have to be able to distinguish between the two, but on the exam next week, you will need to know the difference between constitutional and stereoisomers. That's part of the reason we reviewed those topics in lab this week. The last question had a series of molecules that you needed to identify the functional groups of. I'm going to rewrite the molecules in the note in line structure form, because if you did happen to miss the lab this week, we did a review of line structures in lab, and I do expect that you'll be able to read or to write line structures when we get to the exam. So, redrawing the compounds in the quiz. Let me just take a moment to do that. You can see that all the structures end up being more compact. Okay, so there are our seven molecules. And I'll circle the functional groups that were present in each molecule. Well, except for one of them, because one of them appears not to have a functional group, because it doesn't have any double or triple bonds, and it doesn't have any hetero atoms, but there is a functional group name for it still. So that one that nothing was circled, that's an alkane. A hydrocarbon with only carbon-carbon single bonds. The other hydrocarbons down at the bottom right, that's an alkene with the double bond and an alkyne with the triple bond. Those, as a class, you all got correct. The ones that you all had more difficulty with were the ones with a carbon-oxygen double bond. So if that carbon-oxygen double bond has a hydrogen on it, that's an aldehyde. Whereas if it only has carbons attached, that makes it a ketone. And that difference between aldehydes and ketones is going to come up in lecture again today. So it is important to know the difference between the two functional groups. The last two molecules, the one with an oxygen-hydrogen bond in it, is an alcohol. And the one that only has carbons attached to the oxygen is an ether. So did anyone have any questions whatsoever from the quiz? Yes?
I don't know which direction
the zigzags, how to draw them, it's arbitrary, meaning it's up to you how you'd like to draw it. So in other words, this version of butane I just drew is identical to this other version where the zigzag goes the opposite direction. And you could even, technically, write it like this. So, based off the lab discussion that we had, I could say that these two zigzag versions versus this more like what would you call that? Like a bridge version? Those would be conformational isomers. So the only difference between these is rotating one of the single bonds. But otherwise, they're all perfectly valid ways of writing the same molecule. Before I begin with new material today, did anybody have any questions from our discussion of water or our discussion on thermodynamics? I know that our discussion of thermodynamics, you might need a chance to read over the weekend, especially because there's quite a bit of material that was outside of the textbook. And the main purpose of me doing that was so that I can give a more concrete definition to what a catalyst is. A catalyst is something that both biologically and commercially is incredibly important. And so I wanted to give a little bit more detail to that discussion of a catalyst. What I'll do on Tuesday, though, is I'll review the material we did this past Tuesday to let you know what more specifically is going to show up on the exam. Because some of it I gave just as information to fill in the story, but since a lot of it is outside of the textbook, I'll give you an indication on Tuesday which of those topics you are going to be responsible for, which ones you're not. Now, if you weren't here for Tuesday's lecture, you didn't get the announcement then that we are going to go ahead and move on to chapter 16 today. And that's because we've just recently covered the organic chemistry chapter, and I've talked a lot about biological examples in class, and chapter 16 is all about biochemistry, different types of biological molecules. So because it's been recent in our discussion, I thought it made sense to go ahead and move into this chapter next. Most of what I'm going to say today is actually based in the chapter, although yet again, to give a little bit more full picture, I might go slightly outside of the chapter. But unlike chapter 15, I'm going to try to stick with more with what's the material in the chapter itself. So there's several different types of molecules that are discussed in chapter 16. And the first type are carbohydrates, which means, for the most part, sugars, different kinds of sugars. Now, what is a carbohydrate fundamentally? It's a molecule that has the formula C H2O, with the whole thing in parentheses, and an X. So in other words, any molecule that you can reduce down to having the same number of carbons and oxygens, and then double that number of hydrogens. So that's why it's called a carbohydrate. Its formula is based off of carbon and water. There are different size carbohydrates, and there's different types of carbohydrates that have different functional groups. Before I even show you some examples, I want to explain a little bit about how the structures of the carbohydrates are drawn in the text. And this is the one portion of the discussion that's going to be slightly outside of the text. Carbohydrates are three-dimensional molecules, and all carbohydrates exist as stereoisomers. So remember that stereoisomers are molecules that differ by their 3D structure. So you can have related compounds that are all the same essential backbone. They have the same bonds connected to each other, but arranged differently in three-dimensional space. And there's a way of representing these molecules by what's known as a Fischer projection. So let me just write one of the molecules out, and let me explain a little bit about how that structure is being represented. So I frequently have referred to blood sugar, which is the molecule glucose, and the version of the molecule that ends up being biologically metabolized is this one. You notice that every carbon in this compound has oxygens on it. So just to make sure that we can interpret this structure, you notice that there's 6 places where there are atomic labels missing. So this is a 6-carbon sugar. And again, pointing out that every carbon ends up having an oxygen on it. That would come from this definition of carbohydrate having equal numbers of carbons and oxygens. Now, which two functional groups do you see present in the molecule? Okay, we have an alcohol. In fact, we have several alcohols. And what else do we have? an aldehyde. So, in fact, let me just go ahead and make this definition. Carbohydrates, sugars, are generally classifiable into two broad categories. One of them is aldose. So this "-ose ending is something that's used in a lot of sugar terminology. So it's even showing up in the name glucose itself. So aldose is a sugar that contains an aldehyde. Now let me explain a little bit about how this structure is being represented here. And I'm going to go into a little bit of detail, in this case just to give some more information. Because your text does show a variety of carbohydrates, and I'd like you to better understand what's trying to be shown there. So in this, what's called a Fisher projection, those atoms that are written left to right, so those atoms that are being written horizontally, those bonds are assumed to be pointed out at you. And then the things that are written vertically are assumed to be pointed away from you. So imagine a curve where the bulging out part of the curve is pointed out at you, like a piece of paper where the top and the bottom are pointed away from you. So imagine that that structure is written along the paper here. And then those things that are horizontal, they're pointed out towards you. So it's kind of like a backbone with arms pointing out from it. It's a convenient way to write the structures because we could write it in a crossbar format. And so if you deal with carbohydrates a lot, many times we use this to be a really quick way to write out the structure. Now, I'm not going to ask you to do this because this is a much more advanced concept, but just to show you once, I want to show you what this would look like in a more traditional dash wedge type of structure. So this is the exact same molecule, and you might not be able to directly interpret to figure out how did I go from this flat structure into the dash wedge structure. If anybody is curious, during the break or in office hours, I could explain it if you wanted to know a little bit more about it. But more of the point to show is it's a little bit more complicated, especially if you were to draw in all of the atoms present. So far, I've only drawn the OH groups in. If I add the hydrogens on top of that, which remember, often the hydrogens are left out when writing line structures, well, it gets to be a kind of a complicated looking structure. A little bit more simplistic, a little bit easier to read in this line format. So your text uses these Fisher projections because it's the simpler way to represent the compound. Now, let me draw another aldose for you so we can talk about the differences between the two of them. And no, you're not going to have to memorize the structures at all. If I wanted to ask questions about it on the exam, I'm going to show you the structures, but you're going to need to know the names of just a small handful of these structures. This is the molecule galactose, which is half of lactose, which is milk sugar. So if you look at the two compounds, there's only one difference between the two of them, which you might spot quite quickly if you take just a look at them. Can you all see what the difference between the two compounds is?
One of the OH and H groups are soft.
That's right. If we look at the fourth carbon down. On one of these, we have an OH group which is pointed to the right. On one of these, we have an OH group that's pointed to the left. So you could say that glucose and galactose are stereoisomers of each other. And because you have the term stereoisomer that we've discussed, I'd like to define another term that's useful, which is stereocenter. A stereocenter is an atom that causes stereoisomers to form depending on how the geometry of the atom is configured. So what I circled here on glucose and galactose, that is a stereocenter, because by changing that configuration, I've changed one molecule into the other. Now the top part there, the aldehyde, turns out not to be a stereocenter. And that's because if you could figure out the geometry of it, you know that it's a planar portion of the molecule. In fact, we can do that because earlier in the quarter, you had a little bit of discussion of Vesper theory. And we talked about some of the simpler types of shapes that molecules can form. So if you look at the carbon that's where the aldehyde is located, that carbon is attached to a hydrogen, an oxygen, and then another carbon. Just three other atoms and no lone pairs. So when you have three atoms and no lone pairs, what shape does that end up being? Close, but that's if we have four atoms attached. Close, that's if you have a lone pair. It's okay, the final's a little ways away. You got time to review. It's trigonal planar is what the shape's going to be. And the point is this, if you have a plane, then you don't have a left-handedness or a right-handedness because a plane is flat, so it's two-dimensional, so it doesn't have the potential to cause stereoisomers. All of these atoms in the middle here, though, that have the crossbars, those are all stereocenters. So different sugars differ from each other in a couple of different ways. One is what kind of functional group do they have, but the other is just based off of how the OH groups are configured. So part of the reason I'm spending so much time on this is that we've learned this terminology in the previous chapter on organic chemistry, and here it is being applied. So I just wanted to show examples of where this terminology shows up in real life. Now, let me show you just another couple of examples of sugars. Another very common sugar is fructose, which is a type of sugar that shows up in fruits. So the structure of fructose looks like this. It's somewhat similar to glucose, in fact. Where if you look at the bottom three crossbars, or to use the term now, the bottom three stereocenters, they actually are the same configuration as what we have in glucose. But you notice the position of the double bond is different now. instead of being on the top carbon, it's on carbon number 2. So what kind of functional group does it make this? It's a ketone, that's right. It's the other one with a carbon-oxygen double bond. And so that gives us the term ketose, which is a sugar that contains a ketone. So, again, trying to apply some of the terminology that we learned, what could you say is the relationship between glucose and fructose? They are constitutional isomers because if you counted carefully, they end up having the same number of atoms. But one of them has the double bond on the first carbon, one of them has the double bond on the second carbon. So their bonds are in different positions. So same chemical formula, different chemical structures. So glucose and fructose are constitutional isomers. So now you've got a clear example, a biological example of stereoisomers and an example of constitutional isomers. Now, one last small detail that I don't believe is mentioned in your text. You notice that I'm labeling these sugar names with the letter D in front of it. That stands for dextro, or right-handed form of the molecule. So you might remember that I had said that biologically, sugars occur in mirror image forms. So there's what's known as the D form and the L form. It's only the D form that ends up being metabolized, and the way that you can identify which form of the sugar is if you look at the bottom of the molecule, the stereocenter furthest away from the aldehyde or ketone. When that OH group is on the right-hand side, that's the D form of the molecule. When that OH group is on the left-hand side, that's the L form of the molecule. Your text doesn't show any L sugars because they're not the ones that are used biologically. So now, just to maybe reassure you, the glucose, galactose, and fructose are exactly the three carbohydrates that are shown in your text. The text does identify glucose and galactose as aldoses, and it identifies the fructose as a ketose. So I would want you to be able to identify the difference between an aldose and a fructose. And again, if I gave you the structure of a sugar, you should be able to identify if it's got an aldehyde or a ketone in it to know whether it's an aldose or a ketose. Now, let's get into a little bit more about sugar structure. Many sugars, when you put them into water, automatically react with themselves to form cyclic versions of the compounds. And so let me show you what a cyclic version of glucose would look like. It's somewhat appropriate we're doing this discussion in here today because in the other class I'm teaching, the Chem 12 class, the organic chemistry class, they just took an exam yesterday that was all about carbohydrates. So I've been practicing my structures. So this is the version of glucose in its ring format. Now, sometimes the rings form 5-membered rings. Sometimes the rings form 6-membered rings. This happens to be an example of it in its 6-membered ring format. Why is it that 5-membered rings and 6-membered rings end up being favorable? Well, it turns out if they're any smaller, that you start straining the bonds. Then in order to pull the atoms around into such a small ring, it puts strain on the bond that requires higher energy. And so they're not as favorable to form. They can form. So, for example, penicillin has a four-membered ring as part of its main structure. But they're rarer. They're not as common. So five- and six-membered rings don't have that strain due to the bonds being twisted. Sometimes the larger rings are not favorable either. Because imagine that you have a really long molecule and that the two ends have to come together to react to make a ring. Well, if the molecule's long enough, then that molecule may flop around in space, and it may be difficult for the two ends of the molecules to ever meet up with each other. And so in terms of kinetics, how quickly these things can form, larger rings end up being unfavorable. So five- and six-membered rings have that nice balance where it's easy for the ends to be able to meet and react, and it doesn't put strain on the molecule in order to get into that five- or six-membered ring format. So now once we cyclize, and this is a somewhat small detail, but there end up being two different forms that a molecule can make. And let me draw out the other form so you can see what I'm demonstrating here. And even though this is a smaller detail, it is one mentioned in your text. So again, it may pop out right at you, but what is the difference between the two molecules that I've written? It's just the configuration of this right-hand OH group. Now, let me draw glucose one more time in its non-cyclic form to show you what reacted to end up with the cyclic molecules. Because even with the level of chemistry that we're covering in this class, I think you'd be able to follow what's going on here. So the OH group that I just circled, that same one that determines whether the sugar is D or L, it's able to swing around and attack the carbon-oxygen bond that's at the top. And that makes the new connection that ends up turning the compound into the ring. So the oxygen that I've circled in blue here ends up being the oxygen that connects the two halves of the ring together. That carbon-oxygen double bond, when it reacts in real life, it ends up with another hydrogen on it. Because if you open up the bond, that would make the oxygen negatively charged. And so it'll react with water or something else around to grab another hydrogen. And so what used to be the carbon-oxygen bond is the bond I've now circled. Well, just a moment ago, I pointed out that that carbon-oxygen double bond is a planar type of structure, which means it doesn't have any handedness to it. There's no left-hand version or right-hand version, because it's planar. But once it makes the ring, once it comes around in a circle, can anybody figure out what geometry we would have then? So not the oxygen itself, but the other part of what I've circled here, that's a carbon. How many different bonds are attached to that carbon? We have four total, right? There's the oxygen above it. There's the oxygen in the ring. There's this other carbon that's also part of the ring. And there's a hydrogen. So if you have four different bonds to carbon, what kind of shape is that going to be? Tetrahedral, which does have a left and a right-handed form. So in other words, you start out with something that's planar, and you end up with something that's tetrahedral. And that's why there's these two different versions of the same sugar. that only happen once that sugar gets wrapped around the way that I've shown here. And so if that new OH group that forms is pointed down, that's in its alpha format. When the group is pointed up, it's in its beta format. And where those terms will come up in just a moment is the difference between starch and cellulose. They're really the same thing if you break the two things down, starch and cellulose. It all depends just on the geometry, though, around glucose. Starch is nothing more than glucose connected to itself. Cellulose, in a sense, is nothing but glucose connected to itself. Yes, question. These are glucoses, so sorry, let me write this in. I know I jumped around a little bit because I did show fructose over here, but then I came back and showed you a cyclic version of glucose. So just wanted to explain what this alpha and beta terminology is before we use it in just a minute here. Now, we're going to have to take our break in a moment, but one little bit of terminology I wanted to give you last. Sugars, besides what kind of ring they can form, how many carbons they have, and whether they're an aldehyde or a ketone, there's one other classification. So you have what are known as monosaccharides and disaccharides. Actually, there's four terms that I'm going to at least define three of them. So sugars can react with water. And some sugars, like table sugar, sucrose, if you react it fully with water, it actually breaks it apart into two smaller sugars, which turn out to be glucose and fructose. If you take lactose, milk sugar, and you fully react it with water, it'll split the lactose apart, and it'll turn it into glucose and galactose. So a sugar that can't be broken down any further is what's known as a monosaccharide. Mono meaning one, and saccharide effectively meaning sugar unit. So a monosaccharide is a single sugar unit that cannot be broken apart by reaction with water. And monosaccharides include things like glucose, fructose, galactose, or one that we're going to talk about in a bit, ribose, as in ribonucleic acid, RNA. DNA and RNA are made up of sugars. And ribose is a monosaccharide. If you take two monosaccharides and stick them together, you get what's called a disaccharide. Di meaning two. So it's a sugar composed of two individual units. And examples of that include sucrose, which is table sugar, lactose, which is milk sugar, and maltose. If you've ever heard the term malt before, well, maltose is another form of digestible sugar. Now, there's another term I'm not going to write down, but if you're in your bio classes, you might have heard the term oligosaccharide. So there's only one other English word that I know of without looking up that has that prefix oligo in it, and that's oligarchy. Does anyone happen to know what that means?
It's where an elite is in charge of the system.
And it's controlled by a few people, right? So that's what oligosaccharide means. It's when you take a few units of sugars and put them together. The other one that matters for us is polysaccharide. Which, what does poly mean?
Many.
So that means a sugar composed of many individual units. And the two examples your text gives you are starch and cellulose. Notice that "-ose ending in cellulose. It's a type of sugar. Now, again, you're not going to have to memorize these. These are kind of complicated, what I'm about to show you. But I wanted to show you the structure of lactose, and I wanted to show you the structure of sucrose, just so we could talk about them for a moment. So I'll do lactose first. So this is alpha-lactose. Why is it alpha? Because of this OH group that I've circled here, the one that's pointed down. Lactose is made up of two sugar units. One of them is glucose, and the other one is galactose. Galactose sounds like the word galaxy, which both of those words come from another word, which means milk. That's why we get the term Milky Way, if you've ever heard of that before. So you do need to know, because this is textbook information, that lactose is made up of these two sugars. But like I said, you don't need to be able to draw the structure at all. Now notice there's an oxygen that links the two sugars together. And what happens is if you forcibly react this with water, the two units split apart, and that one oxygen turns into an OH group, an alcohol, on each of the individual sugar units. Well, in order for them to be two alcohols, we'd need another oxygen, and we'd need two hydrogens, which is what comes from the water that would react with it. So the two units that I've circled, they're the monosaccharides, and this whole thing put together is the disaccharide. Now let me go ahead and show you the structure of sucrose, table sugar. Part of the reason I wanted to show you the structures is to talk about the different types of structures sugars can form. So remember earlier I said that it's common for sugars to form 5-membered rings and 6-membered rings. Well, notice how sucrose has one of each of them. It's got a 5-membered ring as part of its structure on the bottom here, and a 6-membered ring as part of its structure on top. Sucrose is a combination of glucose and fructose. And it's the same situation. It's a disaccharide that if you force it to react with water, it'll break it apart into its two individual monosaccharides. So we're going to need to take our break, but did anybody have any questions on anything we've covered so far before we take our break? All right, then we'll come back in 10 minutes and continue. Want to wrap up our discussion of carbohydrates by discussing just two polysaccharides. So, just to draw a portion of each of these structures, I'm going to show you a portion of a structure of starch and then a portion of a structure of cellulose. So, we skipped over the chapter of polymers, because I wanted to get to our discussion of thermodynamics, and then I wanted to get to this discussion of organic molecules. A polymer, one of the easiest ways to define a polymer, is where a molecule ends up connecting to itself over and over and over again. And that's exactly what both starch and cellulose are. They're polymers of glucose. So if you have glucose in its alpha format, then we have a connection between different glucose units. Where one of the oxygens of one glucose ends up bridging with another unit of glucose. Now, to make this easier to draw, I'm using this curved bond line here. But otherwise, it's just two units of glucose that are put together. The squiggly line on the left-hand side here is showing that there's another glucose molecule that this is connected on that end. And same thing on the other end here, that there's another glucose in the chain. So what makes this starch is the fact that the link from one glucose to another is with glucose in its alpha format. So you might remember a little while ago I was talking about the fact that glucose can come together as a ring, and when it comes together as a ring, there are two different configurations it could have. And the alpha format is the one where the OH group is pointed down. The only difference between that starch and then cellulose is that in cellulose, the glucose units are in beta format. So give me a moment just to draw this diagram out. So again, the squiggly lines are showing that there's another glucose that could be attached on either end. There can be hundreds or thousands of glucose units that make up either starch or cellulose. But the difference between the two is all about whether it's in its alpha or beta format. And not knowing a heck of a lot of biological chemistry my own self, my recollection is that whatever enzyme lets us digest starch is specific for the alpha configuration, which is why cellulose is something that we can't digest. It also turns out that this one geometric difference between the two leads the molecules to form different kinds of structures. So cellulose tends to align in linear format. So you get these lines of carbohydrate structures that lead to some of the types of structures that form in plants. Whereas in starch, it tends to form bundles, more like a bead-like structure. And again, all coming down to whether it's in its alpha or beta format. So these are polyglucose. These are glucoses linked one to the other to form our two examples of polysaccharides. So that wraps up our discussion of carbohydrates. So the next section that the text covers is about lipids, which mostly it covers about fats. So let's get into that. I think I had even talked a few times about fats in the classroom. But let's get some terminology that's introduced in the text here. So first of all, a lipid is a biological molecule that is fat versus water soluble. So lipids won't be soluble in water because the molecules themselves are very nonpolar. As we're going to find out, fat is something that's very nonpolar, and that's why lipids tend to be fat soluble. Now, what is a fat molecule exactly? Well, it's something that's made up of a fatty acid. So fatty acids are long chain carboxylic acids. And there's a table of common fatty acids that's shown in your text, and I'm not going to replicate all of them into the notes here, but there's a couple of specific examples I wanted to show very quickly. And this is where line structures really become advantageous, because to write these molecules out in full format is painful. Because of all the carbon-hydrogen bonds you have to write in, all the hydrogen letters you have to write in, whereas in line format, you can whip right through the structures. So if you're copying these into your notes, the first structure has got a total of 16 carbons. So I'll write 16C here. This next one has 18 carbons. And there's one last one that has, I forgot to memorize it, also has 18 carbons. But allow me a moment to draw its structure out a little more carefully. And that's because I'm copying it from an online source here. So 2, 4, 6, 8. And there's a reason why I wanted to draw this specific acid out. So the first acid is palmitic acid. Which comes from palm oil. The next one is oleic acid. Which comes from olive oil. And then this last one is linolenic acid, which is one of the components of fish oil. The main thing that's common between the three of them is that they all are very long molecules. And they're almost entirely just carbon and hydrogen. You only have the couple of oxygens that are in that carboxylic acid functional group. So with all those carbon-carbon bonds that are nonpolar, and with all those carbons that are tetrahedral, even though there is a small difference between carbon-carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds, all those dipoles pretty much cancel out. So these are about as nonpolar as you can get in terms of organic molecules. Now, however, they're large molecules, which is why they tend to form either liquids or solids. Why? That's back to our discussion of dispersion forces. If you remember, there's two main types of dipoles that we talked about. Permanent dipoles, which are due to structure, and then dispersion forces, or temporary dipoles, which can happen more easily in large molecules, exactly like these. So it's dispersion forces that tend to hold these together as liquids or solids. Now, what else is different about these? Well, palmitic acid is a saturated fat because other than the carboxylic acid, there are no double bonds in the compound. Oleic acid is an unsaturated fat because it's got that double bond in the middle. And then linolenic acid is what's known as a polyunsaturated fat because it's got multiple double bonds in it. Now, those of you who are more health conscious, you might have heard of fish oil before, something that is supposed to be beneficial. Have any of you ever heard of omega-3 fatty acids before? A couple of you might have. Well, what does that mean? Well, omega is a letter of the Greek alphabet. It's the last letter of the Greek alphabet. And when discussing structure of carboxylic acids, we sometimes use Greek letters to refer to positions along the molecule. So the position right next to the carboxylic acid group is sometimes called the alpha carbon. And it goes alpha, beta, gamma, delta, so on through the Greek alphabet. Well, if you take the last carbon on the compound, that's sometimes called the omega carbon because that's the last letter of the Greek alphabet. And so if you count in from the end of this molecule, you can see this linolenic acid has a double bond that's three carbons from the end. That's why it's called an omega-3 fatty acid, because it has a double bond at that third from the end position. So I don't know enough about biology to know why specifically omega-3s are good for us, but you know that I've already discussed in class how unsaturated fats tend to be healthier than saturated fats because enzymes are more able to easily operate on things that have double bonds in them. So omega-3 fatty acids automatically have these double bonds that make them more susceptible to react. So just wanted to point out some of these examples of fatty acids. Your text mentions several others, which if you took your text and went home and looked at the back of your shampoo bottles, you probably find some of the ingredients of your shampoo bottles matching some of the words in this list here. Because I think the other day I talked about how soaps work, right? That soaps come from long chain fatty acids like this, where the carboxylic acid has been turned into something ionic. So palmitic acid, lauric acid, stearic acid, they're very commonly found in slightly alternate forms in shampoos and soaps. So if, just out of curiosity, if you wanted to, go home and compare it to the soap or shampoo you use to see if you've got some of those exact compounds in it. Now, these are fatty acids. What's a fat then? Well, the main form of fat is what is known as a triglyceride, which I may have already shown you what the structure of a triglyceride is, but it's one of the topics of the chapter, so let me review it again. A triglyceride comes from the molecule glycerol. So glycerol is a triple alcohol. It's only got three carbons in it, and each carbon has an alcohol group on it. Glycerol can react with fatty acids. Now let me explain what this notation is here that I've used. So in the middle, I've got this carbon that's got parentheses around it, and then the letter X, and that's trying to represent a fatty acid that has X number of carbons between the two ends. So X could be 14 if we're talking about palmitic acid, for example. So if I take three of those and react it with glycerol, then I can end up with this kind of structure. Where three molecules of fatty acids have combined with the glycerol. Now, does anybody recognize what kind of functional group this is? It's an ester, that's right. And when you combine glycerol with the fatty acids, you have water that ends up being removed. You take the hydrogen off of one of these molecules, or actually both of the hydrogens off the molecules, and one of the oxygens, and that's what ends up making the ester linkage. So biologically, fats can be what the term is hydrolyzed. You can force a fat to react with water in order to break it back up into the fatty acids and into glycerol. So a triglyceride is a triester made out of glycerol. And it can involve either three molecules of the same fatty acid or different fatty acids. And they tend to be some of these longer chain fatty acids. Now, one thing that's mentioned in the text, and this is not something I had heard of before, that it must be something that comes from nutritional science, this concept of what the text referred to as an iodine number. So let me explain what that's referring to for when you go back and read the text. So compounds with alkenes, compounds with carbon-carbon double bonds, can end up reacting with molecule iodine, which will break the carbon-carbon bond apart and end up putting two iodines on the molecule. So an unsaturated fat will react with iodine, but a saturated fat will not. And the text lists several different types of fats according to this iodine number, which, because I had not heard of it before, I have to read again myself to remember that the number refers to the number of grams of iodine that end up with reacting with 100 grams of the fat. So let me just show you the table instead of copying it into the notes, because I found this interesting my own self. So this includes a lot of things that might be commonly found in foods: peanut oil, corn oil, canola oil, soybean oil. And notice the iodine numbers with all these different types of oils. The ones written in blue are from plant sources. The ones written in black are from animal sources. And the thing that pops out at us is that almost all of the plant oils are the ones that have a higher iodine number, which means those are the ones that are the more unsaturated fats, coconut oil being a very notable exception. But flip that around, it tends to be the oils from animal sources that are heavier on the saturated fats. It's only the fish oils that are more towards the unsaturated fat, which is probably why we hear a lot about fish oil supplements, something that not only does it unsaturation, but again, for not knowing exactly why it's important, it often has these omega-3 fatty acids in it. So this is the main focus of this portion of the chapter. It doesn't actually get much into other forms of lipids. So I'll just mention that some of the other major types of lipids are things like cholesterol or estrogen, molecules that are actually derived from terpenes. You might remember me mentioning in lab about terpenes. These are five carbon units that assemble together to form larger molecules. And so those are other types of molecules that end up being fat soluble. But the text doesn't go into any of those, so I'm not going to show any examples now, unless we end up with time later on at the end of the quarter where I might have a chance to discuss. So any questions about our discussion of fats or fatty acids? Then the last type of molecule that we're going to have time to talk about today are amino acids. So amino acids in general are molecules that have both an amino group or an amine and then a carboxylic acid. So the absolutely simplest amino acid is glycine. Now, you might remember a moment ago that I said that sometimes carboxylic acids, their structures can be discussed using Greek letters, and that first carbon next door to a carboxylic acid is sometimes referred to as the alpha carbon. And so this is an example of an alpha amino acid. It's an amino acid in which the amino group is attached to the carbon immediately next to the carboxylic acid. The reason I mention this is that proteins are made up of alpha amino acids. And there are essentially 20 main amino acids that make up proteins. There have now been a handful of others that have been identified over time show up in some creatures that exist under extreme conditions, what are known as extremophiles. So, for example, there are some sulfur or selenium-containing amino acids that are found only in a subset of species that are found, for example, in high sulfur-containing environments. But otherwise, there are 20 main amino acids which are shown in your text. So not to write all these in notes, let me just show you some of the structures of the amino acids. So all of these, I can get rid of the glare here, one second. All of these shown are alpha amino acids. So for example, if we look at alanine, one of the simpler amino acids, you have the carboxylic acid group attached to a carbon. And on that same carbon, we have the amino group. Now, in this particular version, it's got a negative charge on the carboxylic acid and a positive charge on the amino group. I'll explain why in just a minute. The other thing that's attached is a methyl group. Remember that a methyl group is a one-carbon attachment. And it's attached at that same alpha carbon as the amino group and the carboxylic acid group. And in fact, all of the 20 common amino acids all have this exact same essential structure. If we use the variable R, which stands for radical, which radical can mean, in a political sense, someone that's way out on the spectrum, but the term radical itself literally means the thing that radiates outwards. So we use the term R to stand for a variable name frequently in organic chemistry, and it can refer to all the groups in green in this diagram. They're the extra bits, the R groups, that are attached at that alpha position. And there's a variety of functional groups that show up in these what are sometimes known as side chains. So we can have alkanes, like what we have with alanine with its methyl group. You can have alcohols, like what we have with serine, shown down at the bottom here. You can have what's called a thiol. That's the sulfur equivalent of an alcohol, an SH group instead of OH group. And that's what shows up in cysteine. You can have things that are aromatic, like tryptophan, the amino acid that supposedly makes us tired after a big turkey dinner. Phenylalanine also is aromatic. This is an alternate way of writing a benzene ring. That circle is trying to show the fact that the electrons are all shared around. Some of the amino acids have another acid in them. So aspartic acid has a second carboxylic acid group as its side group. Some of the amino acids have another amino group in them, like lysine. Now, let me explain really quickly why it is that your text shows these amino acids with positive and negative charges on them. And the reason is the amino group in an amino acid is actually a base. In fact, it's a Bronsted-Lowry base. You might remember talking about Bronsted-Lowry bases and talking about ammonia. Ammonia having a lone pair on it that could react with an H+, even though there's no OH in its molecular structure. Exactly the same thing happens with amines and therefore amino acids. Well, an amino acid is an acid. It's got a carboxylic acid group to it. So if you put a base and an acid together, the two of them are going to react, and so you get this charged form of the amino acid. And that's why in that table in your text, it has all the amino acids shown as their charge forms. So let me just write some commentary out here in case you're looking at the notes later. Since amino acids contain both an acidic and basic functional group, amino acids frequently exist in charged form. Now, we'll come back to that idea of charge in just a second. Oh, my goodness, I didn't realize. Your text actually uses the word. Okay. So since your text has it, I can use it here. This form where you have both a positive and negative charge is called the Zwitter ionic form. Now, Zwitter comes from the German word zwei, which means two. So the sense that this word is trying to communicate is it's something that has two aspects to it. Like this has both positive and negative. So that's what the term Zwitter ionic means. So since these have both acids and bases on them, that's why they often will exist as Zwitter ionic forms. Now, it's not really shown in the structures in the text, but just returning one more time to this concept of stereochemistry. Since the average amino acid, the only one that's not like this is glycine, since the average amino acid has one of these R groups on it, that means most amino acids exist as stereoisomers. Oops. Wait, no, that's right. So since I hadn't written it in the notes, I think, before, this R, which means radical, that's the organic equivalent of a variable. Most amino acids have a side chain, and so they have a carbon that ends up having four unique attachments to it. In lab, you might remember me holding up models with four unique attachments to a carbon, and I showed you that that means you end up with mirror image forms. So amino acids have D and L forms, just like sugars have D and L forms. And whereas it's the D forms of the sugars that are biologically active, it's the L forms of amino acids that tend to be biologically active. And I happen to write this generalized structure in its L format. Not something you need to memorize, but I just want to bring up the topic of stereochemistry again. So now, what ends up happening with amino acids is they get combined together. So I'm just going to take two sample amino acids, ones with somewhat simpler structure. And I'm going to go ahead and show them in their somewhat incorrect non-charge forms. So this first one with just a methyl group is alanine. And this next one with this upside down V-like attachment, this what would be called isopropyl attachment, this is the amino acid valine. And they can be combined together to form this kind of structure. So you still have the alanine on the left, and I flipped it upside down to make this a zigzag structure. You have valine on the right. This is what is known as a dipeptide, which is a combination of two amino acids. Now, what type of functional group is linking the two amino acids together? It's an amide. Now, that amide connection in a biological context is sometimes referred to as a peptide bond. A peptide bond related to this term dipeptide. It is the connection that joins amino acids together. Why does this matter? Because if you build a long chain of amino acids and make a polypeptide, well, that's effectively what a protein is, a form of polypeptide. So I've shown you the simpler case of where we only have two amino acids that have been stuck together. Now, something about functional groups you should know. Amides are some of the less reactive functional groups that are out there. That ends up being a good thing for us because if amides were terribly reactive, that means proteins would fall apart. So it's just a side note to say that it's important that the proteins do exist as this combination of amides. Now, there is more of this section that we need to discuss, but I can tell that I'm going to run out of time before I'm able to get through what I need to get through. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up our discussion for today right here. Does anyone have any questions on amino acids, though, before we end? So we're going to continue in chapter 16 next week, and then I will be doing a review on the test on Tuesday so that you know which topics that you do need to study for.